and I think I'm so smart. I just think I'm so funny. But I'm actually a gigantic piece of shit. Bye.
So I got that message from Bobby on September 27th at 8:50 p.m. It was attached to a animated shit emoji that he sent me. I recall unprompted. I don't think that came out of anything. Bobby, your rebuttal.
I don't see what the problem is. You do think you're so cool, and you do think you're, and you are actually a piece of shit. So,
anyway, I just wanted to start off with an illustration of my friendship with Bobby, because
the prompting
it's indecipherable and indescribable to many.
I got a new phone and I wanted to play with it. And I don't know if you know this, Ian, on the new iPhones, you can animate yourself as a shit emoji. So
is that something I can't do?
What phone do you have?
I don't know. A 7, I think.
can you do an animoji on an iPhone 7? That's a good one, Ian. That's a good one.
Who are you trying to make look bad right now? How you doing, buddy?
Terrible. Hey, did you know this is the year anniversary of our recording of our very first episode?
Today is?
Yeah.
Wow, no, I did not know that.
How I know that?
How do you know that? Did you look it up?
No, at the very beginning of our first episode, I was talking about my brand new Nintendo Switch. And then you were talking about how bad you felt because you didn't know it was my birthday the day before.
Oh, God damn it. I hate you. You're the worst. Oh, man. Bobby, I don't have Facebook, and you don't talk about your birthday. That's not fair. Happy birthday, man. No, I'm an asshole. No, what did you do?
Nothing, really, man. I watched a couple of Sopranos episodes.
Bobby is sincerely, for the record, one of my very best closest friends, and I am an asshole for not knowing it was your birthday yesterday.
I only brought it up, man, to make you feel bad. Because
I know you did.
I don't actually care.
Yeah, I know.
Turning 26 is not an accomplishment. So.
Yeah, you fucking idiot. You were not. How old are you? You turned to what, 31?
Yeah.
Do we not talk about this? Are you a classy
lady? I turned 31. I was 30.
Are you 32?
Yeah, I'm 32.
Okay. Sorry. My mom, on my birthday this year, convinced me I was a year older than I was for like 3 days. and then I realized she was definitely wrong and called her back. I'm not a super observant person or good with details in general, so when people correct me on things, I generally just assume they're right, you know? And that was one of those examples.
Well, it's also weird getting to the age where, I mean, we sound like idiots because we're only in our, you know, early mid-30s, but when you get to the age where you start to lose track, you're like, right, someone could tell me right now that I was 34, and I'd be like, yeah, probably.
Yeah, it's a strange feeling.
Yeah.
How you doing, man? What have you been up to?
Oh my gosh, I've been up to so much because it feels
What are you into, Bobby?
What am I into? So well, that's a private question.
No, this is going to be what we change the podcast name to. I'm trying to get people used to it.
I was using your joke, Ian.
Yeah, I know, but
sounds
you
like
ruined
a
kink
fetish thing. And you should have said, and what are you into?
And what are you into? Alphabetically, like we talked about. Apple, what are you into?
I made a list.
That's your new nickname.
And I'm just going to run through because I've been into so much.
Yeah, we both have had a busy couple of weeks of media, I think.
I rewatched all of The Good Place.
Excellent show. It's finally caught up on that.
An amazing show. Are you on the third season? It's great.
I have started. I watched the first half of the first episode. You know, it's kind of basically a two-parter. I watched the first part. But I have not seen much more than that. Yeah, the show just stays so good. Everything about it is great. Ted Danson is a light in this world. He's an incredibly talented man.
I can't believe how good that entire cast is. Also,
no, everybody.
Like, they lucked out with every single member of that
Darcy
cast.
Darcy Carden is quickly becoming one of my new favorite comedians. I've always loved Kristen Bell, obviously. I like Cheers and stuff, but I've never fully appreciated Ted Danson as much as I think I do now. Yeah, He's wonderful. And every single writer I respect in comedy is working on that show. It's insane.
Yeah, I didn't notice that until this time when I was watching
Joe Mandy and Jen Statsky and Megan Amram and just all of these people. Like, this Demi, is a show that if Harris Whittles were still alive, he would be in the writer's room for this.
Absolutely.
You know?
It's something. I put that one on there because I wanted to run through it because I have like 20 things, but...
Yeah.
I didn't mean that to sound as bitchy as I just made that sound, too. Like, hey, asshole, I didn't mean to make that whole thing take, like, 5 minutes, but thank you for dragging it out.
No, I didn't sorry, yeah, go ahead.
So, rewatching Good Place, rewatching BoJack Horseman, which I'll probably pick in a future episode. I started watching...
I've tried BoJack Horseman. It's Horseman. It is a little... too much ennui for me. It actually kind of takes me to like a dark place. And I've heard other people say the same thing. I like it. I respect the show.
That's absolutely what it's trying to do.
Yeah, but it's just like, I don't know if that's something I need in my life. Like, I think I get my my depression and anxiety from my own real existence just fine, you know?
Yeah, I live a pretty... happy life, so
yeah,
I like experiencing all my sadness through life. That sounded again really bitchy, but I also actually I was trying to be cute about like, no, Bobby, my life is pretty okay. I don't,
Bobby, I hate to break this to you, you're a little bitchy.
Yeah, that's my rapper name, Lil Bitchy.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite things about you.
I started watching The Handmaid's Tale, which is incredible.
That's another one I watched. How much have you watched?
I have watched 7 episodes.
I watched, minor spoiler alert, I watched the first 3 or 4. Got to the female circumcision episode, and I had to quit. There's an episode 4 or 5 in where a woman who is capable of giving birth is gay, and they hang her girlfriend and then circumcise her so she's not tempted anymore. And it was like a month after the election, I was just like, I can't do this. I just can't do this right
now. The execution of her girlfriend is traumatic.
It is. I watched every moment of every episode of that show. I watched with my hands unknowing I was doing this, gasping and holding my hands to my face for the entire hour each episode. It's just too much. And it's kind of too real.
I do think,
but I've heard it's excellent,
that Elizabeth Moss gives one of the absolute best performances in the history of television on that show, because that whole show is a close up on her face.
Yeah, and,
ooh, she conveys so much with so little, and it's really good.
Her being a Scientologist is a bummer.
It's a real bummer. It's honestly very much a bummer.
Yeah, because I'm a huge fan of her art. But yeah.
I'm a huge
I'm minorly commenting on these, but I can stop.
I'm just gonna cut out like part of my list. I'm playing Undertale, which is something I'll probably talk about more next episode. I also saw this film called Mandy. It's this like weird hallucinatory revenge flick. The director is Panos Cosmatos. Yeah, it's a new film. It was out a couple weeks ago. It's still playing in very limited release, but
maybe I could see it out here.
It's
probably San Francisco.
It's a weird movie. I don't. If you came back and were like, I straight up hated that movie, I'd totally get it.
Cage is one of those people that I will go see any movie he makes if I have the opportunity and it's not too expensive. Like, I'm interested in a Nicolas Cage performance no matter what the movie is. You
it
know?
Uses
like
at the very least,
it's
going to
be interesting. Yeah.
Of Nicolas Cage. He does very quiet and nuanced acting for the first half of that movie. And then by the end, he's snorting cocaine off a battle axe and crushing people's heads with his bare hands. So it's just the greatest.
One of my favorite half hours of television still to this day is the episode of Community where Abed has to try to decide whether Nicolas Cage is a good or bad actor, and he loses his mind. he flies too close to the sun.
There's a televised Q&A after the movie I saw with Panos Cosmatos, the director, Linus Roach, who's one of the co-stars, and Nicolas Cage, and Kevin Smith moderates it.
Oh, fun.
Nicolas Cage is just, I mean, like, he actually is just a caricature of himself in real life. And
yeah, he's a crazy person. I love it.
Kevin Smith was like, ask them all, you know, if you could do any movie, have any role you wanted, what would it be? And Nicolas Cage's question is a very earnest, well, obviously, my first love is the sea. And
this is a pretty good Nicolas Cage accent. I'm not even kidding. I didn't know you had that in you.
But he goes on to talk about how his dream project would be obviously Captain Nemo, and he'd spend his time on La Mer. He kept on saying La Mer instead of the sea, and it just was like talking about how obviously his dream role is Captain Nemo, but it's like this unattainable thing for him. And I'm like, I feel like there's a studio out there that would absolutely
bankroll.
Yeah, how
is that? I feel like Nicolas Cage is still of the persuasion where he can just call his agent and say, hey, is there a Captain Nemo out there for me that somebody, like, right? Like, mm-hmm. There's got to be 500 different 2000 Leagues Under the Sea scripts out there, and somebody's looking for their stunt casting. Like, I don't know. That's because I feel like that is what he does. I think he does a lot of these smaller movies because he can't, like, they'll take him, you know? Like he just get, like if you and I were making a film right now and Nicolas Cage reached out to us and was like, can I be in it? We'd say yes, because why wouldn't we? And so like that's happening, I think, with him a lot. That's why he does a lot of these weird movies like this, like that I've never heard of. And
it's amazing.
I assume there's probably no one else famous in it, right?
I get the Andrea Riseborough's in it, and
oh sure, yeah, she's super. She's like A-lister.
Fuck you.
I totally know who that is. Is she from Riverdale?
I just want to strangle you right now.
If she was really from Riverdale, that would have been, we would have had to end the podcast there, because I would have killed you with that sick burn.
She's a little too famous for Riverdale, so.
Okay. Oh, okay, okay.
But it's funny, too, because, like, there's a question. Kevin Smith asks him, or it comes out in the Q&A that he was approached for the villain, who's like a psychedelic hippie. Who kidnaps our hero's wife, and that's exactly the kind of role you would want to cast Nicolas Cage in. This guy who has like rambling monologues that don't make any sense.
Right, right, right.
And Nicolas Cage rallied really hard to get the hero role in it, and you get the distinct impression it's not because he thought the villain role was beneath him, but he goes, I couldn't really grab onto anything I could relate to in that role, but this other role, you know, there were things in my past that I could like really draw upon, and I could give a sincere performance. This role has him fighting another guy with a chainsaw. Like it's a bonkers role, and it was just, he just very earnestly goes, I felt like there were things in my past that I could draw upon to kind of like you know, sincerely deliver this role. It's good. I mean, if you're a Nicolas Cage fan, you should definitely watch
it. Cause... Yeah, I'm totally in. Okay, really quick. 3 seconds to think about it. Favorite Nicolas Cage movie? Or favorite Nicolas Cage performance?
Oh, God. I don't even know.
Three.
No, I can't.
One. Okay, I already had... That's not fair, because I already had one loaded, but...
Face Off?
No, not Face Off. Although when I was a kid, I thought that was like a really interesting artistic movie because they had to act like each other. I was very impressed by that. I forget his name, but from Kick-Ass. I really, really like him in Kick-Ass. That's just a beautiful, beautiful role all around.
Everything
he does and the way he's directed, they use him perfectly. The Adam West voice is incredible. He actually shows like Nicolas Cage range in a great way.
He brings 110% to that role.
Yeah. Well, and he's so perfect for the earnest, insane person who also is a father and really, really loves comic books. Like all those things work so well together with that role. It was kind of like he was born for that.
So what we're saying is we will find funding for a 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea movie, Nicolas Cage, if you'll be in it.
By the way, I just said 2,000 Leagues Under the Sea. You're correct. It's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I also want to point out last episode, I was re-listening to it the other day, and I said the words art with a capital H very clearly on the podcast, and you did not correct me, nor did you edit it out. And so I spent the last day in kind of a shame spiral because of that. So if anybody we know still listens to the podcast, I do understand that art does not begin with an H. I suppose I just misspoke. I'm not quite sure what happened there.
I do remember giving that a brief thought and wondering if you meant heart with a capital H, or if art with a capital H was a thing that I didn't know about, and I was just like, I'll leave it.
Thanks. Thanks, buddy.
No, I was the one who felt stupid while I was editing it, because, you know, there was a lot of self-doubt going, and I'm like, all right, yeah, I guess that's a thing.
No. That's totally fair.
The last thing on my list that I'm leaving off, because I'm assuming it'll be on your list too, is Spider-Man.
Sure. Yeah, let's just start talking about Spider-Man. So Bobby and I have had this insane, like, love relationship with this game. Have you beaten it yet? You beat the story.
Yeah, I'm working on 100%.
Okay. So I 100%ed this game. This is the first game I've done that with in a very long time, probably in 8 to 10 years. That game blew me the fuck away, man. I don't even know what to say. Spider-Man is an incredible video game. It had almost everything I want in it. I think if they just released DLC for the next 5 years, I would keep playing it every month just with this exact same engine. Like, I don't...
Yeah. This could be, like, one of those expansion model games where they could just keep building on the game they already built, and I'd be perfectly happy with it.
I have never seen a better traversal system in my life. Mm-hmm. The combat system is absolutely equal to and on par with the beat-em-up style of something like Arkham, mm-hmm. which is, I think, the finest you can get with beat-em-up style games. It feels a lot like that, or Shadows of Mordor, or something like that.
It heavily builds on what Arkham had put in place, but absolutely. It just fine-tunes it in such an amazing way.
Well, here's the thing. I love the Arkham games, and I love Batman. I'm a big comic book guy. Spider-Man has always been my favorite character. Peter Parker, really, has always been my favorite character. I love his life as a superhero and not as a superhero. I can't think, actually, of another superhero that I care nearly even a little bit as much about their love life and personal life as I do about Peter Parker. And this game recognized all that and made a game about Peter Parker. And it's just really good. Everything about it is so smart and perfectly done. And you told me a little while ago that you had read some interview with and of course they're going to say something like this, but it still made me happy. You said that in an interview, the developers basically said, yeah, we want to start an extended video game Marvel universe. This will be like our Iron Man. And Iron Man is kind of a perfect movie, which is why that worked for Iron Man. This is a perfect video game. I mean... Not perfect. There's a few little things that I would change, but they're very small, and they're things that I absolutely forgive in a video game of this quality. I want to play it right now. I'm waiting. I keep checking to see when the new game plus is going to be released because I want to start over and play it again. It's just incredible.
I was thinking about how why certain games click for me immediately and why certain games don't. And I was thinking specifically, I was putting in my brain, this is before Spider-Man came out, Mario, something like Mario Odyssey and something like The Witcher, which everyone assures me is a great game, but I, for whatever reason, have the hardest time. And I think the act of controlling a Mario is so just immediately instinctual. And sure. The act of controlling a Geralt of Rivera is, I'm not saying it's not rewarding, it's not great, but... It's not a little bit like jumping into a tank and learning all the controls, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah, it's not intuitive in this way. And you pick up Spider-Man and you just are Spider-Man.
I was going to say, legitimately, I think Spider-Man might be the most fun video game character to play as.
That traversal system is perfectly designed. You start off and it's got a nice learning curve so you can look cool even though you don't know what the fuck you're doing. And then you just get so, like, the slow motion aiming and the tricks and the running up buildings and the way you bounce off. Like, everything is so fluid and looks so good. And
it gives you 5 different ways that you can build that character and level up that character.
Yeah.
That, I didn't put any stock or any points into upgrading my suit powers until after I'd beat the game, really. And I never felt underpowered. I knew exactly how I was playing Spider-Man, and it would work for me. But I imagine there are some people who played the opposite way and upgraded their suit constantly.
I have 2 kind of complaints. They're not really complaints. One of them is actually that. I think that the first suit power, you get the focus power that lets you do a lot more finishers. I think that's kind of so good that it just has to stay your default. Whenever I did screw around with other powers, I would try them for 20 minutes and then go back to that one.
I literally never used it.
Oh, you didn't?
No. Well, it's funny. There's eventually you get a power where you call in a drone who just electrocutes everyone.
Yeah.
And that's the one I used. And that also is a little overpowered. Interesting.
Okay. But then the other thing is, I will say that I think the last boss fight is, and this is something we see in a lot of cinematic video games, and honestly, it's a big weakness with the Arkham series, which we're comparing this to. That final boss fight is a really boring, quick time event. It just kind of is. It's a really good cinematic experience, but it's not, I mean, that game, like, some of the boss fights in that game make you feel like Spider-Man to the degree. I'm going to be honest here, and, you know, I've been in an emotional state lately, so I'm more emotional than normal, so take that into account. But I started to tear up a little bit at how pretty fights were, and how, like, when you're, and not because they're, like, spoilers, deep or anything. It's just, well, that's true. Yeah, sorry. I'll add something at the beginning saying spoilers.
You can just blur out.
Yeah, that's true. But
because I just said it.
Yeah. But those fights are incredible. I mean, you feel like Spider-Man, and you feel like you're Spider-Man in those Stan Lee comics that I read when I was a kid. You know, it's just I don't know. I can't say enough about how much I was impressed by that game.
Yeah, I've become as far as video games, I've become sort of a grouchy old man and pedant about how storytelling unfolds in video games. Right. And how divorced they often are from the mechanics of games. And this game follows a gameplay cutscene format.
Sure.
But, I mean, like, this game is a Spider-Man simulator. And so, I mean, there are moments in this game. And I thought the storytelling and the writing is so good that the emotions were so high in that final boss fight. Even though I died once because I was confused as to exactly what I was supposed to do in that final boss fight.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about stuff like that. I'm saying, because I agree with you. But, I think, for the most part, I forgot it. But when the boss fight goes on a minute too long and it's still just the same buttons you're hitting or whatever, like all that kind of stuff.
But I was going to say I was first thing I did was pause the game and try to get hilarious selfies with the final boss. But like after...
You can do that during boss fights. I didn't even think of that.
There's a moment where... a bomb goes off partway through the game, spoilers, but not specific spoilers. You make detours as different characters through the game, yes. Which I'm not like a huge fan of, but they're brief. And I get the function.
Finish your thing because I want to talk about that.
I get the function that they are performing within the story of the game, but the character you play as immediately after the bomb goes off is stressed out and sweating and, you know, going through a war zone, basically trying to find a loved one. And I stopped and took a selfie with every single person. his character is rendered to look really sweaty and gross in that scene, but he still smiles and makes a signal with his hand and stops.
That's pretty
selfies.
Funny, actually. Okay. I will say that I disagree with you overall about those sections, mostly because I am very happy that those other characters are made into more main characters. This kind of becomes Spider-Man and Friends a little bit.
Very much so.
I will say that something that I was bummed by that I want them to do a lot more with, and I imagine it's something they were kind of trying out and maybe they're going to use more in DLC or something, that scene where you are playing as MJ during a hostage situation in a building and you are directing Spider-Man who to take down so you can get around, I thought that was extremely cool. That was a really cool superhero mechanic. I thought that was a really strong way to give her some agency within an action story as a love interest with no powers, and I want to see more of that kind of stuff. It also was just a cool mechanic. I thought I'd never really quite seen anything like that. So, but it was about 5 minutes long, and then they didn't touch it again.
All those sequences are about 5 minutes long, which is a good thing.
But the rest of them are, you know, like you said, they're cool narratively, but they're not. I mean, the rest of the time you're playing as a superhero and you feel like a superhero. So when you're in these roles, you don't feel like that as much, which makes it the tension better, which is why you play as them in those specific moments. But that one specifically, it just was a new thing. It felt cool.
There's another frustrating thing, because one of the other characters you play as, I think about 50% of the audience knows that that character will eventually get superpowers. Right. And so especially during the third act of the game, when they start introducing a slow-moving train of that character's like a superhero right. origin story happening, I'm like, just give this character powers already so I don't have to like jump through hoops to like make this character interesting during the game, like during their levels. The character's already very interesting, but like
yeah.
you know, this character starts hacking stuff and I'm like, oh my god, stop.
I do think it's funny, and I texted you this, like, Mary Jane has been written well by people, but Mary Jane is not really inherently, I think, a super interesting character. I think that Brian Michael Bendis wrote a very fantastic version of her in the Ultimate Spider-Man series, because that's a 15-year-old who's dating a 15-year-old who's Spider-Man, and that's interesting. There's, like, lots of interesting things to do with that. But, I mean, as an adult person, she just doesn't have a whole lot to her as an individual. So with this game, I think they tried to fix that. And apparently the only way to fix, like, 2D love interests in superhero stories is to make them a plucky reporter. I guess there's no other way to do that. You just have to make them Lois Lane, which I'm not mad about. I was fine with it. But at the same time, I'm like, can we come up with a new one, though? Like, do they always have to be a reporter? I don't know.
I loved her in this game.
I do too. I love her. I'm fine with that version of her. It's just funny that they took the thing that is also 300 other love interests and 300 other superhero stories and just put it on her.
There's
with kind of no justification.
Another quick thing about this game. I'm a person who hasn't read a ton of Spider-Man comics. It takes sure. place in kind of like an interesting parallel universe where Spider-Man has been Spider-Man for about 8 years, I believe, right?
Yes, yeah. And yeah. He's out of college, so he's done his high school and college Spider-Man years, which are the classic Stan Lee Spider-Man years.
And so he's met and defeated a lot of his villains. You start the game on the Kingpin, you know, he's already fought Scorpion and Vulture, but it becomes a clear immediately that certain iconic Spider-Man villains like the Green Goblin and Doc Ock haven't happened.
Don't exist yet. Yeah. And they do really a really good job of that with the backpacks. The backpacks are like the stupid coffee cups in Alan Wake or whatever. They're the thing that are usually banes of people's existences, but they were cute. I thought it was
fun.
It's a fun way to learn what has already happened and what hasn't already happened. You know, you can say like, oh, okay, so this is like, you get to see Peter and MJ's relationship. You get to see some of the high school, you know, like stuff that Peter built or tried to build that didn't work. And I don't know. It's cool. It's very cool. I liked it.
Another thing, I mean, that's cool about that is you get to know the map of New York, the very condensed map of New York that this game presents you. But then there's like, I've never been to New York, but there's really interesting things like Wilson Fisk.
Also, I would say calling this a very condensed map of New York is pretty disingenuous. That game feels
Oh, it's
enormous.
Huge. It's a gigantic map. But like, I told you, I noticed things like Fisk Tower is clearly a stand-in for Trump Tower. And then I looked up on a map where Trump Tower was and went to Trump Tower, because obviously Wilson Fisk has to be in in Hell's Kitchen.
Right.
And I went to where Trump Tower would be in real life, and the Rand Corporation is there. And that's kind of fun. Or I tried to find the Richard Rogers Theater, which is where Hamilton is, and there is a theater there that vaguely sort of kind of looks like the Richard Rogers Theater, but it's the theater that's a front to like a research agency in Agent Carter, you know, like it's level
fun.
Of detail is insane to me.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff. The first time I drove, I swung by a giant purple lit building and then realized it was the Wakandan embassy. I got really excited. Like, there's a lot of stuff like that. Although I will say it's very mean to make a game that good, put the Avengers Tower in it, and have it literally be nothing but an empty building that you can't go inside of.
It's a good game, man. I mean, you can swing through Greenwich Village. I'm sorry. I'm going to take that again. You could swing through Greenwich Village and swing by the Sanctum Sanctorum and it's just there.
Everything
it's
is cool. in there, yeah. Okay, so we can't. Well, we can do this forever. So let me talk about a few things that I want.
Okay, good. Yeah. That's what I want.
Okay, so I also after I beat that game, I was really jonesing for another video game because it was so excellent. You know how sometimes you just like have to find something new to play right away. And I started playing Detroit Become Human, which, how new is that game? I was under the impression it was like a year old at this point, but a bunch of people are talking about it all of a sudden. So is it a brand new game?
No, I thought it was about a year old.
Oh, okay. Weird. Then people are just in my life talking about this game right now for some reason.
Oh, no. You know what? It came out in May.
That's old. I mean, I thought maybe it came out this month, and I just didn't know that.
Is that right? I guessed on a number. It's about 4 months, right?
Yeah, something like that. But it's really good. It's a really, really interesting science fiction slave narrative, a la Blade Runner or something like that. You play as three different characters. It is the same studio that made Heavy Rain, which I never played, but Bobby, I know, has strong emotions or strong opinions about, rather. And I will say that this is good. I have heard the complaints about Heavy Rain. I could see how somebody who made a game like this would make a game that was, you know, bad in those ways. This game really, really impressed me. I think in about a month I'm going to go play through it again and try some things out differently. It's cool. I liked it a lot.
I want to try it out. When I played Heavy Rain, my thought was, I can't wait to see what the studio does next, and then I never played any of their other games. So.
Right. With Heavy Rain, do they have that flow chart at the end of each chapter where it shows you... So something they do with Detroit, which is really interesting, is there is this flowchart that shows up at the end of each episode, and it only shows you the things you have done, but it shows you the spaces for other possible tracks.
Oh, no. That's cool.
So you can look through, and then it also, you can look at the entire flowchart to see, like, what versions of chapters you didn't even see and things like that. Again, it doesn't spoil anything. You can't actually click on them until you've done that version of events, but it just shows you how large the possibilities are, which is kind of cool. All the acting is really good, too. That game got a lot of pretty big people in it. Clancy Brown is in it. Minka Kelly is in it. As I told you, I forget his name, but the least interesting character from Cabin of the Woods is in it. And everybody's really good. I liked it quite a lot.
That's crazy that they got Bradley Whitford.
Yeah, definitely. He is not the least interesting guy in that movie. He's great.
I just keep fucking with you.
I know.
Heavy Rain's interesting because they got a bunch of, I forget, where is that, is it located in Montreal, that studio?
Oh, I have no idea.
They get either a bunch of French-Canadian or French people to play American people, and all of their accents are...
horrible.
Offensively bad. Like,
well, they're also kind of doing, like, Humphrey Bogart, hard-boiled detective-style voices, too, right? So I'm sure it's even more of a caricature of American accents.
For the most part, they're just, like, everyday people who...
Oh, okay. I thought it was, like, a very hard-boiled game.
There is a hard-boiled detective character in it, and he's good.
Okay.
He's fine.
Okay. There's a version of that in this game, which is really fun. So basically, there's three characters. The inciting incident, which you get in the first 45 minutes for each one, there's a character who is the android. So these are all androids. It's a future where androids exist and are basically, the world building is cool. Somebody in Detroit in like the 30s invented androids, mm-hmm. and Detroit all of a sudden became like a real city again. Androids are everywhere, but they're treated like slaves because nobody thinks they're alive. And all of a sudden, of course, because that's what the story is about, they start waking up. You play as three different characters. One is a young female android who is picked up from repairs, figures out pretty quickly that her owner has been beating the shit out of her, as well as his own daughter, and shoots and kills him and to protect the daughter and runs off with her. The second one is a guy who has a kindly old artist man who's kind of taken him in as a son, who helps him, or who he helps. He's like his assistant. And then that guy is killed by his junkie son, and the junkie blames you for it, so you have to go on the run. And then the third one you play as is a android who was created by the corporation to hunt down deviant androids. And you can play him as, you know, Nazi sympathizer or as, you know, unsure hero with a heart of gold as you'd like. So there's a lot of really interesting potential with each of those characters. It's kind of fun.
I really want to play it. You're selling the shit out of it right now. So.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
I have I have another game on my list before that one on PS4, and then after that I'll play Detroit for
okay.
sure.
Yeah, yeah.
My other game is you know.
Yeah. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about is I watched the third season of Preacher, and that show is still excellent. It's such a good adaptation. I think in some ways it's kind of stronger than the original source material because I think some of the source material has aged pretty badly. I probably have said that before. And they're just pulling everything that's beautiful out of that comic book and making a really good show out of it. So
Seth Rogen's
everybody should watch Preacher.
Doing a new Garth Ennis thing, right?
There were talks that he was going to direct The Boys. I don't know how that's possible.
I just Googled it to try to not make an ass of myself right now.
Yeah. But I don't think it's happening anymore.
That's
though.
Not I what
that
was I was talking about, but that's the first thing that comes up when I Google their two names together.
Okay. I'm not sure. What are you talking about?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay. Cool. Good talk.
Yeah, I know.
So that's what's going on with me. Do we want to get to our picks for the week?
We probably should.
Yeah, I know it's not that important to you because I'm editing this time, but, you know.
I'm giving us permission to be quick, at least through my selection, but...
I think Bobby's embarrassed by his selection this time, which is really interesting.
Well, okay, well, you're first, so let's talk about your...
Yeah, thing. Yeah, okay.
My thing is better than your thing.
So, I, again, picked two episodes of The Sopranos. This time we are doing an episode from season 3 called Employee of the Month, and then an episode from season 4, the season 4 finale, actually called Whitecaps. Before we start, I do want to say, as just a disclaimer, this first episode, I do want to talk about, obviously, the first episode is about sexual assault.
Very much so.
In a pretty graphic way. It's about the ramifications of that. The episode is almost entirely about Jennifer Melfi, who experiences a sexual assault in the episode. I was really nervous about picking this.
And we're going to talk about it sensitively. We're not going to be assholes
about
the way we talk about it.
We definitely are going to be sensitive. But I will say that one of the reasons I was nervous about picking this, and I think this is from the brief amount that I've talked to you about this beforehand, basically the episode goes like this. Dr. Jennifer Melfi, who is the therapist of Tony Soprano, we see a bunch of her life where people are basically like trying to judge her or tell her what she should do or making fun of the fact that she sees this patient. As she's going home one day, she is attacked in the stairwell of her office building and is sexually assaulted. The police get involved and they find the guy, but the chain of evidence is ruined and he goes free. And she goes into this place and sees a placard for the employee of the month of the restaurant, and it's the man who attacked her. And she now knows, you know, where he is. And Jennifer Melfi has this really, really interesting relationship with Tony Soprano. We talked last time about how Tony is basically a kid, and he is. And Jennifer, in a lot of ways, is a surrogate mother for him. He at one point decides that he's in love with her and like is going to have her. And of course that's a very interesting part of the show because Jennifer Melfi is not going to cross that line.
Oh, interesting.
Part of her wants to, and you know, Tony is a dangerous person to have love you. So it's interesting, but, that has already all happened. So this is a moment where he is like, he feels a lot for her. We see in the scene where he hears about the car accident, like he feels really scared for her and he's trying to hide that in front of his wife so she doesn't get jealous. There's just a lot of stuff like that. Basically the episode is about Jennifer realizing that she could get this guy killed if she wanted to and what the social implications of that are for her. And it ends with Tony asking her if there's something she wants to say. And she looks at the screen directly at us with a completely bruised and battered face and tears in her eyes and says no. And the episode ends. Now, I will say that there is definitely a very valid way, and I think this is maybe your thoughts on it, to talk about that as using rape as a springboard to have a conversation about something else. And I think that's fair. I think, however, also it needs to be understood that for somebody like me, I'm a straight white dude, right? I have not really ever had to worry about sexual assault in a sincere way in my life, or at least not nearly as much as other people in the world. And when I first watched this episode, I was 22 years old, and it blew my mind in terms of how everyone was reacting afterwards, how easy. I did a lot of research into this because it really kind of captured my imagination. And then also I was just a very philosophically inclined young man. I wanted to know if there was kind of a moral structure to the universe or not. And basically what this episode is saying is there isn't. And you can go to people like Tony Soprano. This is the reason they exist. The reason the Cosa Nostra was created was because there were people who were willing to do bad things to stop other people who were doing worse things. And when you give them enough power, they become monsters in their own right. But it's easy to give them that power because they help you, you know? And I don't know. Everything about it just really, really impressed me. The relationship that Jennifer has with her ex-husband, I think, is fascinating. I think she is absolutely empowered in the episode, and I don't think that this was a harmful thing to do to her character. And I think that, you know, if you're going to use something like this in a show, you need to use every facet of it and talk about what it's like to be a victim and be around other people who are seeing you as a victim. And I think this does that very well. I think we really get to see a clear, empathetic, in her shoes version of Jennifer Melfi's experience. I don't know. I'm babbling at this point because I'm very nervous about this. But let's talk about it. What did you think of Employee of the Month?
I want to say, first off, like, don't be nervous. I'm going to preface whatever I'm going to say with, also, I'm a straight cis dude who's never experienced sexual assault. So, you know, I have a very limited worldview from where I'm coming from.
Right.
And also, I want to preface with saying, yesterday, just a context of where we are when we're recording this.
Oh, yeah, Jesus Christ. I was thinking about that a lot, too. Yeah.
Yesterday, for the second time with our current Supreme Court, a credible sexual assailant has been nominated or has been confirmed as a justice to the Supreme Court. So the United States Supreme Court has two credibly accused sexual assailants as justice deciding the most important law of the land. And, you know, a lot of people are reeling from that. And perhaps I was a little bit sensitive to that when I was.
Well, I'm reeling from that. And I will say, one of the thoughts that I had while I was watching this yesterday is I actually was kind of happy we were watching it yesterday. Mm-hmm. And here's the reason why. I think a lot about what I'm about to say. So Cameron Esposito this year if you don't know who she is, she's a comedian of note, put out a new special that I have not heard yet, so I can't speak to its quality, called Rape Jokes. And basically it was about sexual assault. She's a comedian who has been a victim of sexual assault. She's been very open about that, and she wanted to do a special about basically rape culture in America. And I think
this is also a year in which what's Hannah Gadsby's special that everyone?
Yeah, Nanette.
Nanette, you've listened. About? You've watched. Right?
I still have not seen Nanette.
Nanette is also very much about sexual assault, and that was on my mind yesterday too.
So here's the thing. That's happening more in popular culture. I would say that in 2001, when this came out, there were not realistic depictions of rape and the ramifications of rape in popular media.
I agree with you.
Something like this could definitely be triggery for somebody, and I can absolutely see why using sexual assault as a inciting incident for a different conversation can be problematic. I also will say that for me, I'm happy I saw this when I saw it in life. I think it helped me with awareness. And I think that there is a way to talk intelligently and healthily about these things that is good for society. So I get and I agree with the dialogue right now that says, let's stop raping all of our female characters to make them interesting. I absolutely understand that, and I agree with it. I don't know for sure that I feel like this falls into that category. And maybe it's just because of my personal experience with it at the time in my life that I had that experience. I don't know. What do you think?
So let's start with there are two things I want to address. One of them is that the sexual assault in question is, it's realistically handled in a way that does not feel gratuitous. Like, it's definitely not
There's absolutely no sexualization or titillation.
Exactly.
In it. It's horrible.
Exactly
it's
what I was about to say. Lorraine Bracco's, her performance in this is absolutely devastating.
She's an incredible actress.
Absolutely no way to not have a visceral reaction to what is happening on screen. And so kind of along the lines of what you were just saying, I started to think about it, and I created kind of a scale from my own personal experience with media, from good to bad, of where, you know, how to deal with sexual assault in media.
Right. So bad is Game of Thrones. What's good?
I was going to say bad is Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, where sexual assault is kind of just a cheap plot device to make a character more interesting, if that makes sense.
Yeah, or to make a darker and grittier story or something.
Exactly. Good, because it was fresh on my mind, is something like The Handmaid's Tale, where sexual assault is intrinsically woven into the story that's being told, and the ramifications
and it's
of it
essentially,
are being fully explored.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And I certainly don't think this is Girl with a Dragon Tattoo.
By the way, Jennifer does have a different demeanor for a while in the show. This isn't a one-off thing. I mean,
that was going to be a question. I took very few notes for this episode, but that was going to be a question. The way I've been approaching the show, because I've been watching episodes out of context, is the show,
of course,
is effectively pretty episodic. Deals with,
and that is hard. It does have a lot of, like, so for instance, I think in this episode, you probably just had to infer that Tony's shitty sister Janice stole some lady's leg so she could get some albums that she wants to sell. Like that's an ongoing story that's been happening for four episodes before this. So there probably is stuff that happened in the middle that you're kind of lost about, you know?
Right. And, the idea, I'm glad to know that Jennifer Melfi deals with this, after this episode, because,
I mean, I would say it's disingenuous to say that. We don't always see into Jennifer's personal life to this degree. We do. This isn't irregular, but it's not the norm either. But we definitely, I mean, she is still experiencing it. She is playing the character as if she is someone. The next episode, she doesn't just come in and say, like, all right, what do you got for me today, Tony? Like, it's the acting equivalent of making sure you still have the bruise makeup on your face, because the next episode takes place within a time period where that would make sense. You know, it's not, they don't spend a lot of time on it.
I'm going to be straight. A lot of this conversation is, I think it's true for both of us, at least for me, is me throwing my hands up in the air and going, like, I don't know. I can only speak for what it makes me feel. And my,
well, let's talk about different. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say my experience barely matters to this conversation. What you were saying earlier about sexual assault being used as a springboard for a different conversation. You know, I was thinking about, like, because I was upset after seeing the depiction of it.
Of course.
Which is the intended result of that scene. That scene works for whatever, you know, the creators intended it for. But, you know, I started to think, like, did it need was it necessary for
could
it
have
to
been
have
been something else?
Yeah.
Could it have been just, like, a really violent mugging or something like that?
And I think, to varying degrees of success, the answer is yes. I think it could have. I don't think it needed to be sexual assault. I don't know that it even needed to depict the actual sexual assault as disturbing as it was. This is going to sound absurd.
I would agree with that. I think that the sexual assault scene is not the reason I picked this episode. I think that everything else that happens after that and before it is the reason I picked this episode.
And this is going to sound absurd. Yeah. My favorite movie of the past 15 years is Mad Max Fury Road. And that movie also is built, intrinsically woven into the fabric of its storytelling is sexual assault. And it never depicts any sexual assault, but you still don't necessarily, you don't not feel the effects of sexual assault, if that makes sense.
Right.
And so it's just like, it's in a weird bubble of, this is definitely shocking to watch. This is definitely upsetting to watch. But was this a story that needed to be told this way?
Can I talk about what I do like about the episode?
Absolutely.
So I think something that I really like about the episode is that Jennifer is a yuppie. And so she is a psychiatrist who is surrounded by other psychiatrists. Her ex-husband is a psychiatrist. She goes to a psychiatrist. And these are both men in her life who are very liberal and educated, who are failing her in the way that they talk about this assault and everything involved in the assault. They just both are. And so that makes this a personal journey for her, which I find really interesting. I really, really like the scene where she's talking to her therapist and she basically reveals after this, she's talking about this dream sequence she had that I think is really well shot. The Sopranos does dreams extremely well. And she says, like, well, I can tell Tony and he will kill this person and I'm not going to do it, but I could. And the therapist says, oh, and then he starts to say, you know, Jennifer, civilization. And she looks at him with disgust and tears in her eyes and goes, oh, relax. I'm not going to break this social compact. And the way she angrily, I mean, they're having a philosophical discussion. These are academics who are having a philosophical discussion, but they're having one about an actual thing that's actually happening. And it's about her being failed by society in a bunch of different ways. And having this person who would do anything for her, and he would, even though he's a bad person, and she knows he's a bad person, he would absolutely, I mean, that's, you know, we see in the next episode, Tony's a bad guy, but he's not a bad guy in the way that, like, he's not, he would never hit his wife, he would never kill a kid, like, those, we can call those cop-out morality bullshit things, but they are true. He would never let someone get sexually assaulted or hurt that he cares about without retribution. And she knows that. And I mean, in that dream, he's depicted as a dog. I really like that this isn't an episode about Tony and that Tony really has no agency in the episode. He is under Jennifer's power. She makes a decision when the episode ends. Right? Like, the whole episode is about her, and it's about how everyone else is failing her. It's not about Tony. It's not about her psychiatrist. It's not about the larger world of all this. It's about this personal journey she's going through with this experience. And I liked all of that. I thought that was extremely well done. And I like the way Jennifer talks her way through these experiences. Because she's a psychiatrist, the writers get to kind of cut directly to the thematic meaning of what's happening here with her. And I just really enjoy all of that. I think it's extremely well done.
And like you were saying, we sort of explore through four different points of view, or four different men,
yes,
how to deal with this issue. We have her husband, right. We have her son and Tony, who are kind of on the same side of, let's just kill this guy.
Well, but also her son is posturing. I mean, he's a sophomore at Bard, and we've met him before, and he's a nice kid, but he's not a...
But he's 100% pure fury, you know? Like, he
right. But we look at him saying that, we roll our eyes a little bit. We say, like, oh, this is a man who is, I mean, I look at that scene and I say, like, oh, he, just like the dad, is performing anger for her to tell her he loves her. But that's all he doesn't know how to, like, he doesn't know what the right thing to do here is, and that's not the right thing to do. You don't walk in the room and start screaming you're going to kill the person. Like, that's about him.
You know,
right?
It's interesting. Okay, so maybe this is because, and I was going to say, but I had written down my second point to this is, the way I'm experiencing the show might not be the most ideal way to experience the show, which is very episodically.
I agree. And I think that's true.
And I think
really quick, I will say when, look, if you rewatch that scene where she's talking to her son and then rewatch the scene where she starts crying in front of Tony, Tony is much, much more worried about her than her son is. Her son is angry for her, but he wants to leave that room and kill somebody. He doesn't want to hug her and make her feel better.
You know,
Tony, weirdly, at the end of the episode, immediately goes over to console her, and he is scared.
But Tony, like,
Tony's seeing his mom cry right now. Like, he's really scared.
Tony doesn't have the full picture of what's going on either.
That's true. You're right.
Tony thinks that she's been in a bad car accident and that she's traumatized.
Yeah. And definitely he will do that also, I suppose. Yeah, so that's, I guess you're right.
And I think also it's because I look at the scene with her husband and her son, and I... Yes. Again, because I, you know, am a straight cis dude who has never been sexually assaulted, I immediately, because I also, because I haven't watched a ton of Sopranos and I've never met her son before, I immediately relate to the son. Right. If I was in his position, I'd want to go out and I'd want to.
Oh, I would too. I totally someone, would too.
You know?
Yeah. But we won't, like, and neither will the son. That's what I'm saying.
Right, right, right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Tony would.
Yes, yeah. Tony absolutely would. In a second, that's immediate. If she told him what happened, he would get up and walk out of the room and go into that place and kill the guy. He just would.
And I think largely my,
and he would probably try to protect her from that knowledge.
My discomfort with this episode, which again, I'm not going to deny that it's very well produced, insanely well acted, is because I'm experiencing it episodically. It felt like a of the week sort of episode.
A very special episode, sure.
Right, and I felt uncomfortable that as much as I think, oh boy, it feels uncomfortable to even say it. As much as I think that Melfi's position at the end, Dr. Melfi's position at the end is a compelling choice, I think is probably the right choice. It felt like a weird, clean bow to tie on this this event.
That's fair. That's fair.
And I, you know, at the end, I'm like, God, if it had literally been any other sort of crime, I suppose the stakes would have been diminished a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's about stakes. I think I agree that I get what you're saying. I totally do.
I want to say it's depicted responsibly, but I don't know if I, in the year 2018, think it's used well, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, what about in the year 2001?
Yeah, no, then if we rewind 17 years, I think if we take it
I think in 2001, this is a positive presentation of awareness about a social issue. Like, I do.
And again, I think it's depicted
responsibly. I think now that our conversations about how writing works around women have changed so much, that has changed, and I think that's right. But I don't think this is like, I don't know. I don't feel Jennifer Melfi is disrespected by this episode.
Yeah. And I think,
if that makes sense.
I think at the end of the day, we both certainly agree with each other about certain things about this episode, and we both sort of understand that we're not the best people to weigh in on this topic. I'm not trying to like give us a pass or kind of like pass the baton or anything.
This is welcome to the covering our ass section of the podcast.
I want to say I'm not.
No, I know. We're both idiots who are talking about TV shows we like. We're not here to be experts in identity politics and social representation.
But and I'm not upset at having watched this episode either.
And I tend to understand, and I expected most of what you're talking about. I don't think you're wrong in most of those things. I just, for whatever reason, feel differently. And that's, I don't know.
I see your point of view, and I don't think it's illegitimate or anything. And
thank you.
You're especially coming from the point of view of someone who has taken this slice of popular culture as a whole and not as, you know, a 50-minute segment.
Right.
So basically, my conclusion is throwing my hands up in the air and going,
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Whitecaps then, because that's a little bit different. This is the end of season two. And the reason I picked this episode is this is kind of, we haven't really gotten to see Tony's home life yet in what I've picked for you, at least not in any kind of insane degree. And this is a culmination of about 4 years of sub-stories about Tony and his wife. Basically, everything that they have ever done and not talked about comes out in this episode. So, for instance, the scene where Camilla says, "I left the nail on the counter and you saw it," and he starts to say something. What he's starting to say is, "That was a different girl," and then he stops.
Oh, interesting.
There was a whole, there was like a 6-episode storyline about him dating somebody else. The moment where she says, "You're going to hell when you die," that's from the pilot of the show. So, This is the thing with Furio, with the Tony's, you know, lackey who she fell in love with. That was a season long storyline from season three. It's just everything comes out at once. I picked this because I think James Gandolfini and Edie Falco are both just fucking divine in this episode. They're both so good. Mm-hmm. We get to see both the kids actually act a little bit, which happens a lot in the show, but we just haven't really seen that in what I've given you yet. And I think both of them are really, really good as well. I mean, this is an episode about the basic conceit of the show, that Tony Soprano's family is part of his life. All that falls apart. This is Tony gets divorced, basically, is this episode. What did you think of Whitecaps?
So it's interesting. Last week, when we were watching, when I was watching Sopranos episodes with my girlfriend Laura, and I'd mentioned last week, I know next to nothing about Sopranos aside from, sure, you know, the main actors and the finale.
Right.
Laura immediately mentioned Carmela because she knows
Nurse Jackie.
Yeah, well, she apparently knows more about the show than I do, because she's like,
oh, okay.
You know,
Edie Falco is a freight train of talent in this show.
She's fucking amazing, which is what I was going to say. None of the episodes you've given me so far have really showcased Edie Falco.
I agree. Yeah, and this is her best episode, I think. I mean, she has a bunch of amazing episodes, but she's so good in this.
She's really, really great. It enforces the idea that I have that Tony Soprano's a fucking asshole and I hate him. And
yeah,
I don't,
of course he is.
This is the first episode of The Four You've Given Me where it started to weigh on me a little bit, like my endurance I could take watching Tony Soprano as, sure, the center of a show, just because, sure, I think, like, every single stance he takes in the show, I'm like, I hate you, go away, you know, like, I know the show is critical of him.
You don't think the fact that he, like, actually does move out at the end of the episode and accepts things is,
it,
I mean,
it takes
he throws
him a
temper tantrum
time,
for an hour, you're
but
right.
He also,
but,
like,
yeah,
physically threatens his wife in the process. Like, he goes to punch his wife and punches a wall instead. You know?
He does do that. I will say, I honestly don't think that Tony Soprano would ever hit his wife. I know that's like a weird thing to defend about him, but I think the show made that decision, because otherwise what the fuck are we watching?
Right.
Right? Like, he's got to have some kind of, yeah.
I think that's so true. And much like in the last episode, if you put yourself in the early 2000s, which I was 15 in the early 2000s. I don't know what was going on in the world. But like, maybe it's a little bit different, but still it felt, you know, at that moment, I'm...
No, he's using the threat of physical violence against her to scare her. Absolutely.
And I was terrified.
You're 100%
right. I was so scared for her.
You're supposed to be. Yeah. Because, I mean, that is a scene where you're supposed to wonder if Tony would ever hit Camilla. Like, you're supposed to think he's going to punch her in the face right then. And she is... And it's another moment where you get to see how much of just... He's a kid. He's such a child. When he finds out he got caught, his reaction is to be like, okay, well, let's calm down and it'll get better. It's fine. Like, he's just like, okay, well, I don't want to get in trouble again, so let's just get over it and move on. What did you think of the kids? I thought the kids were interesting in this episode. You don't see a ton of them, but I think they're both very good.
Oh, I thought the kids were interesting. I mean, they're still not in the episode a ton. But I think a lot of the humanization we get for Tony comes through the kids in this episode. And I think the first time really in this episode that you start to think, oh, Tony's being grown up, like Tony's being reasonable in this, is when he tells his son gets into a fight with his mom.
Right.
And
his son is at the age where he's the right now. So when the show starts out, Meadow is kind of the shitty teenager. At this point, she is now in college. She has started to realize what her dad really is, where her money comes from, what her mom has had to live with, and she has a lot of unresolved anger going on right now. That's where she is. So she's like a little young, real person now who's trying to figure out what the nature of her dad's work means to her as a human being.
And Meadow's certainly in this episode less than AJ is.
Yes. So, and then AJ has been this kind of sweet little, like, chubby, dorky kid who Tony is really hard on sometimes because he sees him as weak in a lot of ways, but he also doesn't want him to be a gangster and is terrified that this life is going to destroy Anthony. Anthony is now getting to the age where he's like starting to become a little bit of a douchebag. You know, you can see like, for instance, that moment where he gets that money from Tony to buy something for the mom. Like he's going to go out and buy himself something.
Yeah,
we all know that. He's absolutely. The way he grabs that money and walks out of the room. He's like, sweet, I got what I wanted, buy, and just doesn't even, you know. So there's a lot of that. But then I think we get to break through both of those veneers by the end of the episode and see, you know, I think it's smart the way they have kind of a limited but poignant version of how the kids are reacting to this.
I think there's that scene with AJ and Tony where AJ gets into a fight with his mom, asks if he can move into the what is it, like the
it's basically the theater.
Yeah.
They have an outdoor theater next to the pool that doubles as a guest house kind of.
Right. And so he moves out, he asks if he can move out there with Tony because he can't stand living in his own house. And Tony immediately says, like, no, of course not. Go apologize to your mom. This is
right.
Unreasonable. And then gives him money to go.
By the way, to be clear, that's not Tony being like, I don't want to take care of you. That's Tony. Yeah,
and it doesn't
yeah.
come
so,
off that way.
Tony
either.
Does, and Tony does love his kids. And there are times later where AJ lives with him. That's part of, you know, so it's not that. It is a sincere, like, no, you're going to break your mom's heart if you do
right.
that to her. Yeah.
And I actually took AJ's face as like, really, you're not gonna take my side on this? You know, when he had
yeah,
that
AJ's,
money.
AJ's surprised. Yeah.
Yeah, AJ seems really shocked and hurt by Tony's reaction to him living with him. And you know, I guess now that you mention it, I guess I'm not giving James Gandolfini's performance the benefit of the doubt because that's all conveyed in his performance. You know,
if you rewatch this episode for him, like they do a really good job, especially with Tony and the family, of sowing doubt into how bad of a person he is.
Yeah.
The moment where Meadow gets really angry and says, like, how did you put up with all this shit for all these years? He's a monster or whatever she says. And Camilla says, he's not. And I think you know that. Like, the look on her face feels like it looks like she got slapped because she does know that because her dad loves her and she loves her dad and he has cared for her and worried about her and done all these things for her. He is that person too. It doesn't make him a good person. I'm not saying the show is asking you to feel that way, but like she's head fucked about this. Like she
yeah.
doesn't know how to, you know, she loves her dad and she hates what and who he is.
And Meadow is, Meadow's clear. I mean, Meadow's the only one we see individually, you know, explicitly dealing with the hurt of the idea of her parents getting separated. You know, we don't have a point of view scene from AJ where he's dealing with the hurt of this, but we do follow Meadow up to her bedroom while she, you know, expresses regret internally
yes.
about how she's acted around her parents. And,
yeah.
you know, we do.
Or just looking back on her life and seeing like that life won't exist anymore.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. I also really like about this episode, one of my favorite things about The Sopranos is the juxtaposition of Tony versus the yuppies he lives around. Because Tony, like, that's what the theme song for the show is really great. Because it's Tony going from his place where he beats the shit out of people to his house where he has barbecues on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the juxtaposition. And so the moments where we get to see Tony's gangster come out in upper middle class situations is very funny to me. And I really enjoyed this whole interaction with the person that he's trying to buy and then later not buy the summer home from.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, I agree. I also just think Tony's a total shithead and I want him to die.
No, he is. He is. What did you think? So are we cooling on Sopranos at this point? Is that where we're at, Bobby?
I don't know if I'm cooling on Sopranos. I do think that this is probably not the most ideal way to watch Sopranos because I think a lot of the, not just the backstory, but the built-in affection that you have for some of these characters where you can start to try your, you know, the limits of your affection to some of these characters
mm-hmm.
might be a little bit lost on me because when
sure.
you take
I think that's
when
fair.
You take Tony out of context, I'm just like, yeah, this guy's an asshole. Fuck him, he should yeah. die.
I mean, he is. He is an asshole. I mean, really, the main reason I gave you this episode is so you could see Edie Falco just losing her mind.
And James Gandolfini's really good, too. I'm not trying to, like, yeah. shit on his performance.
This is a Camilla episode more yeah. than a Tony episode, for sure, in terms of, like, who gets to show off their chops. But, yeah. Okay, cool.
Is James Gandolfini's... Is he doing an accent, or does he sound like that? Because
he's doing a very slight accent. There's a really weird two-parter that I love. Sopranos does surreal very well. Mm-hmm. There's a two-parter where he has been shot and is dying. And he, while he's dying, like in the real world, is having this kind of like fantasy dream experience where he is there's a case of mistaken identity where he looks exactly like Tony Soprano and he's in LA and he accidentally switches wallets with him and then everybody thinks he's somebody else. And he's when he talks, he doesn't do the Jersey accent, but he's still got an accent. So it's very weird. Your brain like has a hard time processing it because it sounds so close to what he normally talks like, but it's clearly not what he normally talks like, that it's very interesting. So yes, he is doing an accent.
I wanted to write down certain words.
Or he gets rid of the accent for that episode.
Certain words were just so interesting in the way he pronounces them, and I didn't write any of them down, but I'm like, oh, this is kind of a fun accent, and I don't know how genuine it is or not, but it's really fun to listen to.
He's a good verbal actor. Mm-hmm. He's very, very talented in terms of oration.
I want to say James Gandolfini also gave one of my favorite performances and low-key one of my favorite, I don't know if it's one of my like top 20 favorite movies, but like a underdog favorite of mine, which is Where the Wild Things Are. And I yeah. always thought that was really interesting casting, but after watching The Sopranos, I think it's pretty obvious casting to cast James Gandolfini in the part he plays in that movie. So
yeah, I agree. Okay, well, that was Whitecaps, and Employee of the Month. Are we going to move on and talk about your pick now?
Yeah, bitch.
Experience life. Experience wonder. Experience laughter. Experience sound. Experience love. Experience life. Experience lust. Experience pain. Experience Bobby.
I always try to leave room for my theme song, and I realize it always... involves me saying bitch in some way, and it's so awkward.
Is that true? I've never noticed that.
I think in the past I've said it's me, bitch, and things like that, and it's just yeah. it's me trying to be a professional queuing up my own theme song, and it's just...
No, yeah, it's super professional.
100% of the time it's awkward.
Well, Bobby, I want to say something really quick.
Okay.
We have been talking for a while about changing the name of the episode because we tend to agree with each other for the most part. And I will say that today I'm glad we haven't changed the name of the episode yet.
Oh, no. Can I?
No, I'm kidding. I'm kind of kidding, but why don't you start? We'll talk.
Can I preface this with several yes. caveats?
Sure.
I love seeing Stephen. I'm sorry. I'm going to take that again. I love Stephen Sondheim. It's not an unpopular opinion to think he's one of the best lyricists and composers in Broadway history. Into the Woods, the musical, I think is really, really great. Damn near perfect. But it is also very much a musical with a clear delineation between the first and second acts. And also, film, whether or not we're conscious of it, is... often separated into three acts. And so this film, there are many more flaws. If nothing else, though, the first act of the musical takes up the first two-thirds of the movie, and then there's like a yeah. sprint through the second act in the last third of the movie that feels...
Is that what happened? Is that okay? Because the first part felt real fucking long, and then the second part like happened real fucking fast.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. I want to say... So I wrote down a lot of notes. I thought maybe what we could do is go through my notes and just mm-hmm. talk about stuff.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, here's... So before we get to those, though, I will say that I get... why Into the Woods is a popular play from what I've seen mm-hmm. here. I think this is a bad movie in terms of adaptation in a few different ways, and I'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. I also You know, I've for years jokingly said I don't like Stephen Sondheim because I know it bothers you. And from what I know of it, I'm not kidding. But I'm not serious either. I don't know enough about Sondheim to really make an informed opinion. But my like understanding of Sondheim is it's just like really quick, like bouncy music and kind of an atonal style that I just never really liked. And, you know, you've said to me before, like, oh, Book of Mormon does it. And I think Book of Mormon like satirizes that earnestness in a way that I feel more comfortable with. This music is not my thing, man. I liked the story. I think it's clever, but that like a bump a bump a bump a bump a ba bump a bump a bump a bump a ba and I have a cat and it's on a mat and I ba ba da ba da ba da ba ba da, like it's just, it feels like when I think of campy theater, I think I'm just thinking of Sondheim.
Okay, no, I think that's
my, yeah.
I think that's fair, and I definitely think this movie at least leads weirdly heavily into campy, even though I personally enjoy this movie I don't want to say a lot. I did when I watched it, but then when I was watching it, when you watch things in different contexts, I've experienced this in the other podcast I do, where we specifically talk about bad movies. When you start to watch it specifically considering the viewpoint of the person you've recommended it to, you start to see different things. Certain things start to stick out to you.
Sure, of course. Sure.
And I would say Sondheim's style, what I like about it, and I'm sure there are many theater scholars and musical scholars who have more nuanced and more complicated opinions than I do. But what I love about Sondheim is there is something sort of atonal about him, but his wordplay is just so deliciously.
So for the most part, I wasn't having that. I will say, now here's something I wrote down. This is later. I wrote, Act 3 is interesting, which I thought the first two acts were before the Happily Ever After, and then Act 3 was after. For a second, I was like, wait, why are we keeping going the Happily Ever After? And I'm like, oh, that's the point. Yeah. Like, life continues after. That's interesting. But then I wrote underneath that, I kind of begrudgingly like this stupid Bean song. I think that was the only fast song I liked, where they're all figuring out whose fault it was.
That's really interesting to me.
I thought that was like real quick and funny and fun and clever in a way that I like when people are making fun of Sondheim and do that well. But I had not experienced it yet while watching the movie until that moment.
So it's really interesting to me, because if I had written down one song that I thought didn't translate well to the film,
I don't think it was done well. It was that song. But I was listening to the song and I liked listening to it. I thought it was a cleverly written song. So here's really quick. Last time I said Shannon liked this movie, I misspoke. Shannon really, really likes the musical. She does not like this movie. And so I decided, based on something she had said to me beforehand, I was going to watch the movie and talk about it as a movie, but I also was going to listen to the music and try to talk about just the music. And that was a moment of that for me. I don't think that was well shot. One thing I want to say, I wrote this down too. Rob Marshall's just the wrong choice for this. Like, why is this film like a theater musical?
Yeah.
Why would you take a musical that was about this and film it like you were actually filming a theater musical?
You know what?
There's no reason to have done
that. There's something interesting about this, is I wonder if there was even a good window to make this into a movie, because it is a lot of enter so-and-so, these two people have a conversation,
but there's,
exit so-and-so.
But, like, just have some spectacle. Like that scene where Meryl Streep is singing to Rapunzel in the top of the castle, like they're in a dingy cell and there's no reason for that to be a dingy cell. Like, make Rapunzel beautiful, you know, add some weird CGI magic, do some, like, have little like steampunk baubles on the wall, like do something, have something to look at. There's just, this is not a visually interesting film at all.
You know,
when I was watching the scenes at the end with the giant, I was like, oh, I know what this looks like on stage. You don't see the giant, giant hands and feet come from above into the side of the stage. And I'm guessing that, is that correct?
Yeah. Well, no, not even hands. Yeah. So it's interesting, because the part that the limits of the production really show for me are, Jack, of Jack and the Beanstalk fame, has a song where he recounts essentially the tales of Jack and the Beanstalk to the baker in the movie.
Right.
And clearly the only special effect shot they can afford
is the giant.
Oh, no, not even the giant. It's just Jack climbing up a beanstalk and then climbing down a beanstalk. and on stage.
I did write, oh, so this is a bunch of fables without the cool parts being shown.
Right. And I think we'll get back to this later. I think the point of the show, the point of this whole musical is the implications of happy endings and also, you know, how we deal with our parents and what the stories we tell our children.
I liked that. Yeah, I liked that final song about the children are listening and all that.
Right.
Stuff. I thought
that was cool. That's every single character in this, except for maybe, you know, the kids who don't have the intellectual awareness to deal with it, are dealing with parental issues. But anyway, it's like you can have Jack in a musical run out on stage and sing that song to the audience.
Right.
But then when you have Jack run out and start singing that song to James Corden and climb up a tree and then like cut to a special effect shot of him climbing up a vine, you suddenly feel like you're missing out on something that should be there.
You totally do. Yeah.
A little bit. And I get that.
Here's the first thing I wrote. Meryl looks bad.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
That makeup is not good. Those hands look like she's wearing like glued on fake witch fingernails.
Okay. Interesting.
That's what I mean. Like I looked it up. This is a $50 million budget. Mm-hmm. They should have spent that entire budget on costuming and set design. Mm-hmm. Like that's the way to make this an interesting, like otherwise just go see the stage play. You know what I mean?
No, I totally get what you mean.
Okay. I mean, by the way, there are parts of this that I did like. I thought the Baker centerpiece was cool, and I thought the overall book of it all, like the writing of how these all interact together, was clever. I really enjoyed all of that. The music just was not my thing, is like kind of the main thing.
Can I tell you about things that had to change from the musical?
Yeah.
Okay, so there are a few big changes that didn't necessarily bother me, but they're interesting, I think.
Yeah, I need to know this. This is good.
Two characters got cut out. One of them is there's a narrator in the musical who narrates the whole thing, who's very separated from everyone else.
Was that Corden in the movie?
In the movie, it gets sectioned off to Corden. I sort of understand why in transitioning this to film this got made, but that's also usually a dual role. There's a mysterious man in the show who's helping the baker and his wife get the items they need to break their spell, the family spell.
I see. Okay.
And then that later gets revealed to be either the baker's father or the ghost of his father, who we see for one scene in this movie.
Yeah, he's in. Yeah.
But it's also, I think it's very meaningful that is often a dual role with the narrator. Because the culmination of all of this is the baker, who's in this movie, is played by James Corden, sitting down with his child and telling him.
Who I thought was good.
Yeah, he's great.
But in a bad movie. I think, by the way, I also thought Meryl Streep was
good. She's good.
I just think that costuming was not good. I did not. I liked her better costume later, her non-witch costume. That was fun.
There are a few people who I think are not great in this movie. I think the kid actors are not great.
I like Jack. Or maybe I just like Jack's song.
Jack's song is great. I think Red is... I don't want to shit on a 13-year-old, but like...
Okay, so I wrote... The little girls who proudly tell people they're like Lucy from Peanuts grew up to be like this version of Little Red Riding Hood.
I was going to say this feels like out of a school production of Little Orphan Annie, but...
But it's just like, why is Red Riding Hood a total asshole? Is that... I mean,
yeah.
I don't get
it. And I don't know if this helps with the tone at all. Jack and Red are usually cast like 16 to 20 and they play younger. And that that definitely toys with the tone a little bit when you have someone a little bit older, like kind of campily playing a younger person.
Sure.
There's a second part to one of my favorite parts of this movie is when Chris Pine and Billy Magnuson sing their songs.
So I did write down the princes are pretty funny. I like that scene. That's what I was thinking of when I thought of campy. I was like, oh, some old theater queen directed this because like these are the gayest, like theateriest, like over the top cheesy princes I've ever seen in a good way. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very funny.
And in the second act, you get a reprise of that song, and they're both singing about how, you know, they've, you know, this is the aftermath. They've both won over their princesses, and they're sort of tired of all the emotional baggage that comes with being in a committed relationship.
Right.
And so they're both now in love with Sleeping Beauty and Snow White. And they're kind of singing about, you know, like how there's these new princesses who they're sort of in love with.
Snow White. Who's Snow White?
They never come on stage, but they're singing about.
They start
describing these new maidens.
Oh, I must have missed that.
Who they're in love with.
Okay. That's really
and
funny.
Then it ends with like, that. Oh well, you know, back to my wife. You know, like I'm married now. I can't keep chasing maidens. And then Disney would not let them kill Rapunzel. Rapunzel dies in the second act of the show.
Ha!
She gets she's in the second act when we meet Rapunzel, and it's much more clear that a lot of time has passed between the first and second act in the show. Rapunzel's a mess because, you know, she was raised in an abusive household, and she has these kids now that she doesn't have any context of how to care for them because she, you know, was kidnapped at a young age and raised by an evil...
Wait, there's none of that in the movie, though, right?
No, and so she deliriously runs out and gets stepped on by the giant, and that's when the,
Jesus Christ.
The witch sings a really...
Yeah, there's a lot of... I wrote down at one point, oh, so medieval divorces seem to be no big deal, I guess? Like, there's a lot, like all of a sudden, Prince Charming and Cinderella are just like, yeah, so you know, text me sometime, but yeah, it's been nice knowing you, bye. Like, and then they just pair off with somebody new. It's really...
And bear with
very,
me. I think that, because again, I mentioned that the movie kind of sprints through the second act of the show. So bear with me. When the second act of the show deals with like the aftermath of a giant wreaking havoc on a kingdom, and you spend like 45 minutes of everyone together kind of trying to figure out a way to, out of this problem, and then the prince at the end of that like sleeps with the baker's wife, and Cinderella finds out about it.
Yeah.
She's just kind of like, who cares? You know, like there's a resolution of like, we were always bad for each other. And I see that now.
Well, and then there's also this moment where the baker's wife sleeps with somebody else and then dies. But like she dies off screen, which I guess probably plays better in the play. But in a movie, I'm like, oh, if I didn't see her die, she's not dead. And then like 30 minutes after she died, I was like, that was when I realized she died. I didn't realize until I was rewatching this movie. In a movie, when somebody comes in and says, here's your wife's shoe, she must be dead, your immediately thought is, well, no, she's coming back in act three, right? Like that's, but in a musical, it's just, they're doing that because they don't want to show the violence.
I don't even think that. I think this movie, I didn't realize was rated PG. So, you know, like she kind of, very subtly accidentally backs off a cliff.
Why did it need to be why did it need to be rated PG?
I think maybe Disney producing this was not the best.
No, there's no reason to do that. Why? Like, no kids give a shit about Stephen Sondheim anyway. This is made for theater fans.
Right. And so in the stage show, I hate being this asshole, but in the stage show, you know, she doesn't fall off a cliff. She gets crushed by a tree. But, you know, like, you dim the lights, you have the giant approaching, you have her scream, and then, like, it's effectively telegraphed. However, I think one of the things that really stands from the show in the movie is her song. Her last song, I think, is great. I think Emily Blunt is the best actor in this movie, and I think her scene with Chris Pine is effectively like very, very funny. But then
I like that scene too.
But her song afterwards, where she kind of like sorts herself out and realizes like she needs to leave the woods, is a great scene.
So here's my problem with Sondheim, and I'm having it right now while we're talking about it. And I'm not trying to be a dick here. I don't know what song you're talking about. They all sound like the same song to me. They just like, it sounds like a 2 hour long song. It's, you know, with like fast talking in some parts and then singing in other parts. I liked her in it. I liked what you're talking about. It just all kind of blurred together for me. I will say I wrote something down. I wrote, Johnny Depp is bad in this, but Johnny Depp is not. But then I wrote, but Johnny Depp is not the only thing to blame about this song. That Johnny Depp song, I don't know what anyone was thinking who was involved in shooting that. I don't understand what anyone was thinking who was involved in writing that song. I think that is a badly written song about a really weird tone, and it's just strange all around. I'm not a fan of anything to do with the big bad wolf in this movie.
I have really complicated feelings because I think that song is okay. I'm
not offended by it. It's not because it's like, oh, it's like pedophilic or whatever. I get that that's supposed to be a joke. It just wasn't funny. Like, I just thought it was really, really,
I think
silly. And that hat and everything, like, it just, all of a sudden I felt like I was in a movie, like I was in one of those stupid new Alice in Wonderland movies with Johnny Depp.
I agree,
like
100%.
I
think the song is fine. I think that number is sort of on a different level than why I don't like Johnny Depp in that role. I think on a different level that number is sort of like ill-informed. And I also think it's really unfortunate that, you know, accused wife beater Johnny Depp is playing like the sexual predator.
I mean, that's just honestly, he probably did this before that happened, right?
Yeah, he did. And he's fine. Yeah, I mean, if we're being totally honest,
Johnny Depp sucks. Johnny Depp sucks.
I think he's...
Johnny Depp sucks.
This is far from his worst role. I don't think he's terrible. He's in and out in like 5 minutes. It doesn't even
matter. That was one of the most painful things I've ever watched. I also wrote, so this Giants shit is like colonialism level hate crime, and only Red Riding Hood even acknowledges it. Like, even if they don't kill her, they just beat the shit out of an old lady who wanted to find the kid who befriended her, killed her husband, and stole all of her stuff.
I think the show acknowledges that, though. I think...
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird that Red brings it up, and then no one else talks about it ever again, though.
I think...
Like, that's very strange to me.
There's a...
I'd rather they just don't bring it up.
There's a final song called No One Is Alone that Baker and Jack and Cinderella and Red sing, where, I mean, they're all essentially arguing about how everyone, you know, often feels isolated, but everyone gets to choose their own morality. Everyone is faced with tough decisions, and you have to take the information you've gleaned and decide what's right, because no one's going to decide it for you.
Yeah, you got to protect your own people, because those are foreigners.
But I think at that moment, everyone's deciding, like, we can't give up this kid to a giant, you know? We can't...
Yeah, I mean, he's just a murderer and a thief, and yeah, totally.
I understand what you're saying, but I also think that it explores the nuance of what you're complaining about.
I'm mostly... by the way, I like this more. I'm doing this a little bit for comedic effect, so if it's not coming off that way, I apologize. There were parts of this I really liked. I like musicals. I liked this musical. I would totally see this musical on stage. Mm-hmm. It's just not... I'm never going to buy the soundtrack. That's what it is. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's... I think unless someone's doing something clever with this style... Like, what I like about Book of Mormon is that... The joke is that they're so overly eager to do everything that it plays into their songs as a justification of why anybody would sing that way and walk and dance and talk that way, because they're just high on their own bullshit in Book of Mormon. In this, there is none of that. There's no satire to that. So it just, it comes off as kind of cliche for me. I think part of this is for me. I think Sondheim is like, you know, when you when you were a kid and you saw some Leslie Nielsen movie for the first time, but then you afterwards saw the movie it was making fun of. Like, you saw Dracula after you saw Dracula Dead and Loving It, or you saw the what's the one with Harrison Ford? Wrongfully Accused. You know what I mean? Like those types of movies. This feels like that to me. I've seen so many things making fun of this style that I cannot take the style seriously.
Can I? Okay, so one of the very first things when we started talking about this podcast, before we'd even recorded the first episode, when we were coming up with things we disagreed with, Sondheim was one of them. I immediately came up with three Sondheim pieces that I wanted to show you, and Into the Woods was first, and I still stand by the musical. I think this is the first
I can see why it's a good
and this
musical.
Is the first time
I can see that. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying Sondheim is untalented. I'm saying he's maybe not for me.
And this is the first time I watched I thought this would be the most easily accessible because of the film, and this is the first time I watched the film and realized, like, this is a poor representation of what I'm trying to get across, because the whole thing I'm trying to get across is the second act, and kind of the exploration of you know, like...
I did like all that. I will say the last 45 minutes of the movie were my favorite part of the movie. I really liked Meryl Streep's last song about being the witch. I thought that was really good. I would buy that song, and I would listen to that song.
And I didn't love Meryl Streep the first time I watched this, and the second time I watched this, I'm like, she's really good in this.
She has a rough entrance.
She,
I'm telling you, there's something weird about that. Like, it's just, it looks so cheap, that makeup that they put on.
It does look cheap. Also, she's not a great, I mean, this has been heavily discussed with, like, Mamma Mia, and so she's not a great singer, but
she... I got goosebumps when she sang I Am the Witch. Like, I liked it.
And can I
read to you my, oh, sorry, go ahead, finish with
you. Oh, no, I was just gonna say, there are two more, but again, there are two more things I had set aside. I'm not gonna do them right away. One of them is my personal favorite Sondheim musical, and the only way I can think of to get you to experience it is to hand you the script and to hand you the soundtrack and to have
I'm fine with that
through. And then the third one, which is I think one of, like, maybe his best, that is also to you personally maybe the least accessible, is there are two filmed theatrical versions of it, and I don't know if I'll get there, but I definitely want to get to the second one eventually.
I thought you said you didn't like Phantom of the Opera.
That's Andrew Lloyd Webber, and he can suck my
balls. I don't think so.
No, that's definitely Andrew Lloyd Webber.
I'm pretty sure I'm right about this. Can I read you the two biggest nitpick things that I have? So first I wrote, oh good, they can use the corn. Phew, that was close.
Fuck you.
I also wrote, the Rapunzel hair gag with Emily Blunt makes literally no sense. She grabs her hair and starts to run away, knowing it is... She pulls on it first to make sure it is attached to a human being, realizes it is, holds it in her hand, and just starts running in the other direction. And as she's running, the hair luckily gets caught on a blade sticking out the side of the building. She falls down in, like, a hilarious pratfall, looks at the hair, and then keeps running. Why? She had a knife. Why didn't she just cut some of the hair off? I don't understand anything about that moment in the slightest.
I'm not going to defend that moment.
Okay.
I think Emily Blunt is...
Oh, I also really wrote, where the fuck did $50 million go?
It's a really cheap-looking movie.
It just is. It looks like a stage play. It does. When I looked it up and saw it was Rob Marshall, I was like, oh, I bet you this is some theater guy. And it's not real. I mean, maybe he kind of is.
He's the musical adaptation
That works for Chicago.
Yeah.
That works when you're making, like, something that is featuring the dance of it all. It's not featuring spectacle. It's featuring music and twists and turns and dance and personalities. This is about spectacle. Mm-hmm. Like, these are weird magic, crazy things that are happening, and they Disney made this. Why didn't Disney put some fucking money into this? It doesn't feel like it was worth it to make this version of this.
Almost feels like Disney was happy to attain a popular property that incorporated a lot of its IPs, but then also was afraid to really devote any attention to something that,
like,
deconstructed all of its IPs, you know?
If they put the special effects budget into this, if they put into these live action, like Cinderella or Beauty and the Beast, I would like that movie. I would, because, like, that would be a pretty... There's so many ways to make this a pretty spectacle-filled film. And, like, I'm not even... Like, I get the giant. I get the way they shot the giant. I have no problem with that. That's not even what I'm talking about. I'm talking about everything else. Everything else is just dirt and bricks behind them. There's just nothing going on.
I agree with you. I understand with what you're saying, or I understand what you're saying.
By the way, that's me criticizing the film. No. I will say, I want to make it clear, most of the criticisms that I'm leveling today are about the film adaptation. I will say that I can absolutely tell that this is a really fun, clever, interesting musical. While the music may not be my style, I absolutely see the potential for quality in this as a thing. I would totally go to Into the Woods if somebody invited
me. I'm even going to defend, like, Rob Marshall's eye a little bit. Like, I think with what resources he was giving, he knows how to block certain scenes. He knows how to make certain scenes dynamic in a way
he's able to direct people well on stage.
But also in a way that I think that other people who have been handed musical properties recently haven't been able to. Like, God, I can't forget it. I forget his name. The guy who directed Les Miserables. Or even like Bill Condon, who directed Beauty and the Beast, who made the whole thing feel really claustrophobic. I think, like, Rob Marshall knows, like, okay, I have this one set I know how to block actors around this one set, even though I can't do the right special effect shots that this movie clearly needs.
You're right. It just, it always looks like there's one fake tree behind them and then a green screen behind that. Like, it just, it, you know, you can just tell it's set up like a stage play.
There are things that, like, when you're excited for a thing and you're more willing to forgive a thing, like, I'm trying to think, like, if the most obscure comic book property you could possibly imagine got
a big screen adaptation. I totally get what you mean. This is something you already have close in your heart, and so you see through some
things
of
like,
or see past some of those moments in the adaptation. Totally.
Things like the baker leaving the scene and then Jack immediately entering behind in the woods and the baker's wife being like, "Oh, Jack, you're there," didn't bother me the first time I watched it, but the second, like, this time I'm watching it, I'm like, this is painful to watch. Like, this is so awkward and so obviously theatrical and not cinematic.
Yes,
if that makes sense.
That was the other thing. I think all of the humor, the points of humor, played very theatrical.
I would agree.
Played very much like theater rather than film as well. And I think, I actually think, although I like James Corden a lot, I think he's responsible in a lot of ways for the tone of this. Mm-hmm. I think he has a level of camp and kind of like, I don't want to shit on James Corden, but like there's a lower quality to what he is doing. It just feels low rent. The whole thing feels low rent. And it feels like, you know, Meryl Streep was the opportunity to make it not feel like that. Maybe Johnny Depp was too, depending on the kind of person you are. And they put them in the most ridiculous looking things immediately, so that goes away, you know? And it just, I don't know. I didn't feel any, if I'm going to see a musical film, I want to see spectacle.
James Corden character, this is the last thing I'm going to say about this movie because we should probably move on. The baker is essentially, if you can point to one character, the main character of the film. And James Corden is really good at playing kind of like the comedic. I know among millennials, at least, it's kind of fun to shit on James Corden for his, like, his late night persona.
And I don't hate James Corden.
I don't either.
I
think he's fine. But he's,
I kind of nothing James Corden.
Right. I'm pretty, like, slain on James Corden. But I think he's, like, he's good at playing kind of, like, the comedic, exasperated part he's called to play in this. They cut a key number for him from the show, which is after after the number we were talking about where they're all blaming each other, he goes off in the musical and has this devastating duet with his you know, with the mysterious man who is his father, where he kind of like, it's the big male power ballad from the show where he kind of decides, you know, that where he explores how painful it is to be a father and to be alone and have to deal with the legacy of a father who didn't give you anything. My personal favorite number of the show, and in this it's relegated to him kind of going off into the woods and crying on his own.
Do you think he couldn't hack it? Is that what do you think was?
Because James Corden is from theater. He's a super talented dude. I think honestly what it was film pacing, and I don't begrudge them for cutting out that number, but I think James Corden's limits as an actor show, because he finds out his wife is dead and he has an infant son, and he kind of can't pull off a realistic reaction to that. He just kind of like looks sad for a second.
He kind of stays in the comic relief role the whole movie,
it goes into that song number where they all blame each other, and that is sort of played for laughs. And more than anything this time when I was watching it, I'm like, your wife just died. Like, you should be fucking mess right now. Like, this is the worst thing you've ever had to deal with in your entire life. And you're, like, screaming at a little kid in a very funny way, you know? And it just felt really weird and awkward to me. But we could probably put Into the Woods in bed. I'm going to, maybe in a few months, I'm going to give you a Sondheim thing that you're going to have to read along to about presidential assassinations.
Okay.
But
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to do that. I I will say that I've historically kind of always done this a little bit more to make fun of you than anything
else. No. I sort of agree with you on this one, because I was watching this, and I'm like, God damn it, I fucked up.
Well, but I know the music is important to you, and I have not been sold on the music yet. But I don't hate it either, and I would like to see some more ballads, because the ballads I saw were good. Those quick, clever, like, rhyme, over and over, like, bop, songs are just, they can be a little much for me. It feels like the bad version of Amy Sherman Palladino, like when you watch Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and it starts to give you a headache or something, you know what I mean?
Like maybe I'll send you, just too... separately from this, I'll like send you a YouTube video of his big number in the second act. I don't know if that'll win you over or anything, but it's just kind of like an interesting insight to where that character could go. But
Well, this was a more contentious episode than normal. Maybe we should keep the name.
I think we were like still pretty friendly to each other though.
Yeah. Fuck you, Bobby.
Well, I can't wait for you to tank the content of the show and recommend me a couple more Sopranos episodes.
No, I decided against it. I could give you Sopranos episodes forever.
I was fucking with you just by the way.
I know you can. Can I tell you the two I was going to pick before I decided this isn't funny to do anymore?
Will it matter
people
to me?
Should just watch them? No, but I want people to know what my favorite episodes of Sopranos are. Unidentified Black Males and Long-Term Parking were the two I was originally going to pick. Those are both excellent.
What was the other one?
Long-Term Parking and Unidentified Black Males. Let's talk about... I'm picking something else. In honor of our mutual recent obsession with Spider-Man, I am going to give you about 10 issues of one of my favorite Spider-Man runs ever. It is J. Michael Straczynski, who is a television and comic book writer best known for the Supreme Power comic book series and the Babylon 5 television show, both of which I'm a big fan of. His Spider-Man is really good. It's about adult Peter Parker deciding that he wants to become a high school teacher. And it's kind of the... It's very Capra-esque. J. Michael Straczynski is very earnest in his stuff. It's got a kind of Aaron Sorkin or Frank Capra style to it, and I just really like it. It's very sweet and earnest. I'm giving you 10 issues. The first six are a contained storyline, and then there's a few little single issues in there that are really interesting too, one of which is an issue that was written specifically in response to 9/11.
Interesting.
So there's a lot of stuff in there. That one is, so are these from, I don't think it's like the,
are these from the early 2000s? From,
yes. Okay. So the 9/11 one, I believe, was published about a month or 2 months after. It was pretty amazing.
And so it's just the first 10 issues that J. Michael Straczynski wrote?
Yes. And he did this for a long time. His artist for most of it was, John Romita Jr., who you might know as the artist of, Kick-Ass. And he's really good. This is him at a younger age where he's less kind of stylistically developed. So it's interesting to see where he is. And it's just a really good comic book. So it's issues. It's Amazing Spider-Man issues 471 to 480.
Okay, cool.
471 to 480. And I can send you those. But also, if anybody's listening wants to read them, they are available on the Marvel Unlimited app.
You're not going to send me those because we don't support pirating media, Ian.
Oh, I was going to mail you the actual books that I definitely bought with my own money.
Okay.
That's what I meant.
Well, I'll go to my local comic book store and buy them.
Okay.
Okay, so next time...
You're organically sourced local comic book store?
Yes. I have a barber who knows comic books pretty well.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to pick a show that I'm pretty sure you will not like.
I'm curious.
I'm pretty excited because for this next episode, we're both going to travel back to the early 2000s. I think about, this is a show that in the moment I was very much into. And when I think about television shows of the past 20 years, I can't think of another show that I think has had more of an effect on popular culture, or certainly as much of an effect on television in general, but maybe even popular culture, as much as this show. And so I would like to revisit it, not to speak necessarily of its quality, but to kind of observe a show that kind of grew into a monster in its early days. Okay. So I'm going to assign you two episodes from the first season of Survivor. The reality television competition show.
We have never done reality TV on this show.
We haven't. I think Survivor, I recently rewatched the first season of Survivor, which I was as big of a fanboy of Survivor in its first season as anyone was. It's sort of...
That's right. I forgot you were so into that show.
It's sort of an interesting relic to look back on because it is a very quaint show. The contestants on it don't really have knowledge of reality television outside of, like, the real world. They don't really know what Survivor is. So I'm going to give you two episodes. They're both on Amazon Prime streaming for free. I'm going to give you the first episode. For anyone who doesn't know, Survivor is a show where 16 contestants are, you know, quote unquote, marooned on an island, and they they are giving.
Does anybody not know this? Please write in if you don't. If you've never heard Survivor. Please write in.
I don't know
if
people just have like a broad knowledge of Survivor, but don't actually know the specifics of like how the game unfolds.
I mean, that's true of me.
Yeah, the first the Survivor, you get separate, you get marooned on an island. You're separated into two tribes, and every couple of days, you as your tribe go to face two challenges. One of them is to give you a reward, like waterproof matches or something like that, that will help you with your comfort on the island. And the other one is to decide who goes to tribal council. And the people who go to tribal council have to make a really
What happens in the show if you, like, get the flu?
You know, honestly, I think unless it's life-threatening, you probably just deal with the flu. But if, like, if you're very sick, the producers probably step in and remove you from the island.
Yeah, I've always wondered I've just always wondered, like, because that's...
In the second island, point, it's an illusion. Someone like, falls into a fire and, like, burns their hands, and the producers just remove them from the game. You're not actually, like threatened. Like, your life isn't threatened.
Right. You're playing it.
Right, but you do definitely, like, go through malnourishment and stuff, and you lose, a ton of weight, and you have, like, rats biting
you. That's
what
I mean. Has no one ever, like, sued them for
I'm sure you sign away all of your rights to sue as soon as you sign up for the show. But
that's true.
And then, so tribal council people have to make an exhausting hike to tribal council where they have to vote off one of their own members. So the first episode I'm giving you is the first episode. It's the premiere episode called The Marooning, where the 16 contestants...
That's a super cool title for
the first 16 contestants get stranded on the island. The second episode I'm giving you is the 8th episode. The title of that episode is Thy Name is Duplicity. Yeah. And so what happens in Survivor is halfway through the show, the two tribes merge into one tribe.
Right. And then it's free-for-all,
Yeah, it
right?
becomes less a team competition and more a single competition. So the rewards challenges you go through are personal rewards and not tribal rewards. And then, you know, you're not voting people. You have a more condensed group of people to work with. And so you definitely want to start playing for yourself. In the 7th episode, actually, is when they merge. The 8th episode is the first episode after the merger. And in the first episode, the two tribes, there's Toggy. I forget what the other tribe is called. But Toggy is kind of like the more ruthless, cunning tribe. The other tribe is really kind of like young and idealistic and kind of naive. The younger tribe, after they merged, saw their strongest player get voted out. And they're all kind of reeling because they're playing with this ideal of the game as you vote the weakest person out of the game and not the biggest threat out of the game. And so they're all kind of reeling with the shock of Gretchen, who was their strongest player, getting voted out, and they don't really know what to do with it. So it's the aftermath of that. And I don't know. I think the first season of Survivor is a really interesting relic of popular culture.
I've heard that from a lot of people. I'm interested. It sounds interesting. So I'm looking forward to see what happens.
Yeah. So I don't expect you to like it. I'm not presenting it as like a glowing beacon of quality television.
No.
But...
I, I also, like, I get, I mean, I roll my eyes at reality TV a lot, but there's aspects of reality TV that I appreciate, and the competition of some of these types of shows. You know, I've watched a lot of Face Off. It's the same basic thing, all that kind of stuff. So I can get into that.
So yeah, episode 1, The Marooning, and episode 8, Thy Name is Duplicity.
I really wish they had just called Survivor The Marooning. That was the name of the show. That would have been incredible.
Survivor is very simple, you know?
Yeah. I guess that's probably why you like it. Okay, bye.
Thank you. Hey, Ian, can I tell you yeah. something, though?
Sure.
You're a piece of shit. You're wrong.